It's time for Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Thank you all for being here. Well, the two men at the top of the Republican Party came together for a show of support as they were each heading into a pretty consequential stretch.
No, I stand with the speaker. We've had a very good relationship.
That, of course, is Donald Trump. He was giving House Speaker Mike Johnson a show of confidence, which is not something we always see. Johnson, at this moment, has been facing a rebellion from some of Trump's allies in the House. This is threatening his job as Speaker, and it could well trigger yet another drawn-out fight over who should be Speaker of the House. Of course, Donald Trump has been having his own issues, namely his first criminal trial, the first criminal trial ever for a former president, we should say. In New York, he sat through jury selection in the trial over hush money payments that were used before the 2016 election to cover up an alleged affair with an adult film actress years earlier. So I want to start there with our Left, Right, and Center panel. We have the crew back together again. Mo Alethi, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He was communications director for the Democratic National Committee and an advisor to Hillary Clinton. And Sarah Isger, senior editor at The Dispatch. She is a lawyer. She was spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. It is great to be back together again. How are you both?
It's good to be back.
Yeah, agree.
Always good to be here with you two. Shenanigans ensue.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about shenanigans. Like at this trial in New York, I can't believe, I mean, it's been a circus. It became a circus as soon as jury selection started. You had Donald Trump going on social media to talk about jurors and say that some of them were lying to try to be part of this trial, which the judge said he can't do that. You had the media reporting on some details of jurors to a point where one got excused because she was worried that her friends and family were going to be able to figure out that she was a juror in this trial. I mean, what is this? I know we should be finding ways to hold people in power accountable in our justice system, but is this the best we can do?
Apparently. I mean, look, how is this not going to be a circus, right? For all the reasons you just said. We've got a former president standing trial for the first time in American history. That former president is Donald Trump, who in and of himself is a walking three-ring circus. So, of course, this was going to be unlike anything we've ever seen before. I do think it is sad that we're here. I think it's sad that we are at a point where a former president is a defendant in a criminal trial. I think it's sad that this is the trial we're leading with. We've talked about that on the show a number of times before. Of all the many felony charges against him, the fact that this is the one they're starting with.
The hush money
payments,
yeah.
And it has to do with a hush money payments to a porn star just adds to the circus of it all. And we've got a media that still has not learned how to cover Donald Trump responsibly. And thrives, loves covering circuses. So yeah, apparently
how should
this
they be covering
is the best
him,
we can do.
How should they be covering it differently?
Look, I thought the judge was right to admonish the media late in the week when he had to excuse one of the jurors because her friends and family identified who she was based on media printing too many or reporting too many personal details about her. You know, that's the kind of thing that the media doesn't actually need to do in order to further a story, in order to help explain what's going on. They didn't need to identify what accent she had. There's just got to be, I think, less of an interest in the circus of it all and more of an interest in the service of holding the powerful accountable.
Sarah, is that possible? I mean, as a lawyer, can you look at this and see a way forward where this trial is like in the service of something important here?
Not really. So because there are so many legal problems with this case. As I've talked about before, I think, for instance, on the classified documents case, and especially on the obstruction charges related to the classified documents case, I haven't heard a single person give even a maybe he could try to argue X way that Donald Trump has a defense to that. But on this case, it's just kind of a mess. So what the prosecution has to prove is three things. One, that Trump falsified business records. Two, that he did so with the intent to defraud. Like he knew that they were false. It wasn't like an accident. And three, that his purpose for falsifying the business records was to cover up another crime. So they have to prove all of those things beyond a reasonable doubt. They don't have to prove that he actually committed another crime. So it's all about this mental state. And usually what's in your head isn't by itself a crime, especially if the thing you were doing wasn't a crime. So they don't have to prove that he actually committed an election law crime or a tax crime. And obviously the falsifying business records isn't a crime by itself. It would have been if they had charged him within the statute of limitations, but they didn't. There's a huge legal problem, but that's not what's going to be in front of the jury. The jury is just going to answer those three elements. But I think Trump has kind of interesting defenses to that too. Remember, Michael Cohen's going to be the star witness. Can I read you what Michael Cohen testified to a few months back during the Trump Sure. Organization civil lawsuit? He pled guilty in 2018 to tax evasion, campaign finance violations, the whole host of other little various and sundry crimes.
From when he was working for Trump.
Correct. Well, the tax evasion being unrelated, like his personal, he just wasn't paying taxes. But yes, it's right in that time frame. So he sits under oath during that trial and says that he didn't commit tax evasion. And so then the lawyer gets up and says, like, basically, but you pled guilty to tax evasion under oath. And so she says, so, sir, you lied at the time. You lied more than once in federal court, correct? And Cohen says, correct. Like, that's your star witness. For the prosecution. I don't think it's that hard to believe that a juror, and all it takes is one juror, remember, to be like, yeah, I'm not hanging my hat on the word of that guy who lies so many times, you can't keep the lies straight.
And Trump's team just has to find one juror who doesn't find him credible. And then
that's
and the whole
one
thing
of
becomes
the most-
kind of a mess.
That's one of the most interesting things of this week to me. Look, Michael, this is not the first time that a prosecutor has put a convicted liar on the stand as a witness, right?
Nope, I mean, definitely.
It has happened many, many times before. But this point of like what sort of this hypothetical one juror is so interesting. So much of the focus this week has been on obviously the jury selection and this notion of whether or not the potential jurors could be impartial, whether or not they themselves could see themselves being impartial.
Which would mean they've never had an opinion about some guy named Donald Trump at any point in the
history.
That's not what's required. That was going to be my question to Sarah.
Just to be clear.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
What is required? Yeah, Sarah.
So looking back, for instance, at the Boston bombing trial of the Tsarnaev brothers, there were four jurors who were seated, who made the decision to impose the death penalty in that case, who during the jury selection process said that they believed that the defendant was guilty. But they also said that they could set aside their feelings about that and only consider the evidence that was presented at the trial. So you're allowed to have whatever bias you want, whatever feelings you want,
as long as you can convince the judge that you can
set all that aside. And but like, again, imagine public opinion finding out that like this juror has, you know, said all these horrible things about Donald Trump and yada, yada. But don't worry, they said they could set that aside because the incentives here are so different. I mean, imagine that you're the holdout juror. Imagine the book deal, the speaking gigs, the one-on-one interviews. You want to talk about bad media behavior, Mo? Just wait until there's one holdout and a hung jury on this. And the benefits to being that juror are concerning. It, by the way, just one more note on Michael Cohen because it's somewhat relevant. Michael Cohen back in 2018 was shopping a pro-Trump book deal that he got offered about $750,000 in an advance for. Then he had all these legal problems. The book deal kind of fell apart. So then he wrote an anti-Trump book deal for what they're estimating was probably $1.5 million in advance. Like, so a juror's going to hear that testimony as to why they shouldn't believe Michael Cohen and why he's an unreliable witness who will say whatever he needs to say in the moment to save his own ass. And they're also going to be thinking in the back of their head, but wait, are you saying that could be me?
Huh. Well, can I? I do want to shift to the Speaker of the House, and I want to make the shift this way. As we look
circuses?
At that circus playing out, yeah. Well, circus or not, because it feels to me like Speaker Johnson, even as a lot of Trump allies in the House, led by Marjorie Taylor Greene, are threatening to try and remove him, he's trying to do business. Like, he's actually trying to get this aid package, well, not a package, I mean, there are going to be separate votes, but really important things like U.S. aid to Ukraine, U.S. aid to Israel. And it's almost like this split screen, like this circus in New York, and it feels like you have a Speaker of the House who's actually trying to get really important work done. And Trump, for the moment, seems to be giving him kind of an endorsement to keep doing this. It just feels like such a moment in the Republican Party to me, and maybe this is temporary, but if Johnson's able to get a bipartisan vote through and get some of these important aid deals done and sort of push away the opposition from some of Trump's allies, are we seeing some moment in the party?
We're seeing some moment in the party. I'm still not sure what we're seeing, though. I mean, look, there was no movement in the House on this until Iran attacked Israel. When right. Iran attacked Israel, suddenly there was a new sense of urgency. And so the Speaker put forward this idea. That just, you know, doubled down. That allowed people like Marjorie Taylor Greene to double down and threaten to file a motion to vacate. He scrambled down to Mar-a-Lago, looking for some cover, went down and bowed at the altar of the deity of denialism, and got a little attaboy for it. But when he came back to Washington and announced this aid package, the number of people, you know, a second Republican stood up and said they were going to support a motion to vacate. Just one more person, but that's important because after this week, Republicans lose another member of the House, Congressman Gallagher, who is resigning and leaving office early. There's no right. margin of error. That's enough. That's enough to throw this whole thing back into chaos again. And when the press asked Donald Trump what he thought about that, Trump's lifeline disappeared. Trump's response was, we'll see what happens with that. That's not the kind of ringing endorsement he needs. Look, I think the Speaker probably survives. And I think he will surprise because this time I think there will be some Democrats who vote to save him if it gets to that point. But how hobbled is he within his own conference if it does require Democrats to save him? He's doing the right thing here. But if there's one thing we have seen time and time again in Washington, is that too often the incentive for doing the right thing is to come back and do the wrong thing right after that. He's going to have to find ways to shore up his base within the House conference after this, assuming it passes and assuming he survives. And so I just think the circus is continuing.
But Sarah, it could this be a moment? Let's say these deals go through. Let's say the Speaker survives. I mean, could this be a moment where someone other than Donald Trump, like, say, the Speaker of the House, is making a statement that Donald Trump alone does not run this party? There's work to do. I'm the Speaker of the House. I can work with Democrats, and I can get stuff done.
I don't know that it's Mike Johnson, you know, bucking Donald Trump so much as it's Mike Johnson being like, we can't just do nothing all the time. I'm the Speaker. I want to do something.
Yeah.
But the problem within his caucus really is that they do not believe that getting something done, if you use Democratic votes to get it, is a good thing. And so that's just a huge problem for him moving anything ever. And what we've seen, frankly, for years now, and it's not the Republicans, it's overall the incentives built into the House of Representatives, is voters think that at this point, the president does stuff and the Supreme Court does stuff. They just don't think Congress is the place where stuff gets done. And so Congress is living up or down to that reputation. We've seen across the board just, well, shenanigans from all sides where the backbenchers see more benefit to complaining, calling out the bad part of their own party, incentivizing primaries against members of their own party because that's how you raise money. That's how you raise your name ID, et cetera. There's plenty of names on both sides to throw out there. They're making their bones, if you will, by being disruptors and agitators, and voters aren't holding anyone accountable for the lack of accomplishment.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you just said, but I will say I'm watching this whole debate over aid really closely because it would feel important if the House is able to, say, get more money to Ukraine to fight this war, even at a moment when so much of our politics is looking like a circus. But we got to stop there and take a break. We're going to come back and talk about the state of protests in the United States on college campuses and elsewhere. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Okay, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green, joined by Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy. Here in the United States, we are seeing protests over Israel's war in Gaza intensify. And we're also seeing a rise in anti-Semitism. And this is a particular concern on college campuses. The Anti-Defamation League handed out grades to universities for how they're dealing with this threat and protecting students. Many schools fared poorly. Harvard got an F, Georgetown a D, Columbia a D. The ADL said that schools should encourage protest on their campuses, but to not let it cross the line into hate. And so what does that mean? Well, the president of Columbia University, Dr. Manoush Shafiq, was just on Capitol Hill being asked about this by Republican Congresswoman Lisa McClain from Michigan.
Are mobs shouting, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," or "Long live the Infantada"? Are those anti-Semitic comments?
When I hear those terms, I find them very upsetting. And I have heard...
That's a great answer to a question I didn't ask. Is that fall under definition of anti-Semitic behavior? Yes or no? Why is it so tough?
Because it's a difficult issue.
So Congresswoman McClain, they're meant to say intifada, we should say. And the language about from the river to the sea. The House actually passed a resolution earlier this month saying that the slogan "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free" is an anti-Semitic call to arms with the goal of the eradication of the state of Israel, which is located between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. So the House weighed in overwhelmingly. There were a few dozen members, mostly Democrats, who voted against that resolution. But I want to start there. I mean, the president of Columbia really struggling with how to protect free speech and how to protect students from hate and where that line is, being asked about it by the congresswoman there, saying that this is really difficult. What do you each hear when you listen to her struggling with this?
This is... there are some real challenges with this in that there are people on both sides of this issue who find benefit, some sort of political benefit, in blurring the line between anti-Semitism and anti-Israel, where there should be a distinction. It should be okay to criticize the policies of the government of Israel. It should be okay to be able to protest the way they are waging the war. But there are so many people out there on one side of this who want to frame any criticism of the government of Israel as being anti-Semitism. And there are people on the other side who are closeted anti-Semites who try to hide behind what they would say is criticism of the government, but they go too far. I agree with those who say "from the river to the sea" is anti-Semitic. Any language that infers a call to arms to eradicate a Jewish state, to me, is anti-Semitic.
But this is where we get messy everywhere, and with a lot of these protests, that the blurred line between those two things makes. I mean, there's so many issues with the protesting that's going on right now, but that blurred line is just adding to the intensity of the anger here in here and around the world in the way we're trying to have this. What should be a legitimate discussion.
Well, and Sarah, I want to let you jump in, but as you bring up, you know, your views about that phrase, Mo, I just want to say, like, you know, Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, congresswoman who has, you know, gotten into trouble over this phrase. I mean, she said that From the River to the Sea is an aspirational call for freedom, human rights, and peaceful coexistence, not death, destruction, or hate. I mean, there's been a lot of talk of that phrase, how it's been used by Hamas, what the suggestion is to eradicate Israel. But there are people like Congresswoman Tlaib who have a different view of that phrase. And I guess that's what comes into play here. Who decides what is hateful speech and when should someone like the House of Representatives weigh in, which they have, and how should the President of Colombia deal with that? It is really difficult. But Sarah, let me let you jump in here.
This gets to something that I think came out during the last time we heard university presidents testifying. It wasn't
and lose
that
their
they
jobs
were
over
wrong.
Those, that testimony, yeah. We should say.
It wasn't that they were wrong on what the First Amendment demanded. It was that they never were using that standard at any point before when it was white supremacist speech or pro-life speech or something that they perceived as being on the right. All of a sudden, the First Amendment was flourishing on these campuses when it was left-wing speech. So it was the hypocrisy element. And I think there's something to be said about that here, which is the left has been telling us for years that who gets to determine what is offensive speech, what is hate speech, is the person who it is directed to. So something is transphobic if a trans person says it is. Something is homophobic. Something is racist if that community says it is. Except if it's Jews, right? If Jews say something is anti-Semitic, then we have this whole hand-wringing episode where we're like, well, but is it? I mean, the person who said it didn't mean that it was anti-Semitic. They're claiming that it had this totally other meaning, despite the fact that these terrorists definitely mean it to be anti-Semitic. I mean, we just don't have that conversation about quote-unquote offensive or hate speech dealing with any other group on the left. And so that's where I think people get very frustrated because the left sort of plays Calvin ball with some of this stuff. It's different rules when they're fighting against the right than when it's someone on their own team. Then all of a sudden, well, actually, intent of the speaker matters.
Mo, I wonder how you feel about that sort of charge of hypocrisy. I mean, thinking that through, the idea that the left often says, if you feel a grievance and you have been the victim of hate speech, that is enough to say that this kind of speech is not allowed, but there's a different sort of rule being applied here when it comes to anti-Semitism and some of what we're talking about.
Again, Sarah and I have gone a few rounds on this before. I do not think this continues. This is not a left versus right issue, right? There are when it comes to Israel and Gaza, when it comes to anti-Semitism, this is actually not a left versus right issue. You know, we have seen some anti-Semitic rhetoric coming from the left. We have seen a lot of anti-Semitic rhetoric coming from the right. This notion of hypocrisy when it comes to speech is also not limited to the left. I do think that there has been some hypocrisy on the issue of free speech and hate speech, and I think it's just going to continue to get more complicated. But let's not pretend that it is a problem, a feature of the left. I mean, the way the right talks about wokeism and using that as a reason to support censorship, right? The party, the movement, the ideology that is supposed to be all about freedom and freedom of speech is using this boogeyman of wokeism as a way to censor. And so the hypocrisy, there's plenty of it to go around. So we shouldn't just
frame it as left versus right. I think this issue is going to get...
There's plenty of hypocrisy on both sides, but not related to the... Like, there's just hypocrisy along the political spectrum. I think I've acknowledged that a zillion times. Are you acknowledging that there's hypocrisy on the left on this issue?
Oh, I just did, right? I think among some elements of the left, sure. I don't think that is a feature of the entire left. I do think that when it comes to free speech, there is absolute hypocrisy on both sides, right? That you've got those on the left who, and we're seeing a growing number, particularly of young voters, young progressives, who are saying openly that stopping hate speech is a more important value than protecting free speech. Some of the people who would say that, and were saying that before October 7th, they're crossing the line into hate speech themselves when it comes to this issue. There are those on the right who say there should absolutely, 1,000% be absolute free speech on college campuses. But when they don't like some of that speech, they blur the line between anti-Semitism and anti-Israel and suddenly start demanding censorship. So there is, let's be clear that both sides are struggling, if I'm being generous, are struggling on how to deal with this issue in the context of free speech.
All right, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. And we're talking about this question of whether there's some hypocrisy that we need to confront when it comes to what is free speech, what might cross the line into hate. And I guess as we acknowledge that there's some hypocrisy, as we acknowledge that this is hard to figure out, I guess I'm curious, like we think about the House passing a resolution and saying that this language about from the river to the sea is anti-Semitic. Not everyone agrees with that. But is it helpful to have, say, lawmakers define certain phrases and language as hate to set some parameters so college campuses can say, as long as you are not using what has been acknowledged by lawmakers or whomever as inflammatory language, then you're not crossing the line? Like, is that what we want? That we want some people in power to say this is acceptable, but this is offensive? Or does that take us down a dangerous road and actually limit our free speech if we're saying, like, oh, you people in Congress should decide what's okay?
Yeah, I can't tell you how much I don't like that solution. and I think I have been very consistent on this. I think there should be free speech on all of these campuses up to the point of a Title VI violation, which says that if there is such severe and pervasive harassment because of someone's race, gender, ethnicity, religion, et cetera, that it interrupts their educational experience, then the school can be held liable. So, like, Title VI should be the ceiling for speech, and the First Amendment should cover everything else. And that's just not what these schools are doing. And yeah, Congress defining what is, I mean, anti-Semitism is not illegal. It's offensive, but it's not illegal. You should be able to say something that others find anti-Semitic. You should be able to say something that others find racist or homophobic or transphobic. That's what free speech is. And if it makes you uncomfortable on your college campus, that's why you're in college, is to be uncomfortable and to learn how to debate those issues with people who just come to it with a fundamentally different belief system. At the point that we have government defining what is hate speech, you have already lost all of your First Amendment protections, because the government, by the way, will think that all speech that criticizes them is hate speech. Just look at what John Adams did in the Alien and Sedition Acts. Look at what Woodrow Wilson did in the Second Sedition Acts. He threw 1,000 people in jail, more than 1,000 political prisoners during World War I, on the argument that it was the government that got to define what speech was out of bounds. So yeah, I think it's fine for Congress to define anti-Semitism if they want to. by all means, feel free to say something is anti-Semitic, but you don't get to then, that doesn't have any force of law or force of anything else when it comes to someone's speech rights on a college campus or anywhere else.
Lest anyone think that Sarah's examples are the only ones. I want to throw a Republican in there. Look at what's happening in Florida right now with the efforts to regulate what content can be in school libraries and whether or not that's offensive. So I'm with Sarah actually quite a bit on this, and we have, I think both been consistent in our belief that we should allow as much speech as possible on a college campus. The obligation of a university is to protect your right to an education and protect your safety. That's it from in my perspective. So if an offensive speaker comes to campus, you have a right to protest that to the extent that it doesn't impede on anyone else's right to an education and right to safety.
And right to hear the speaker.
To me, that's part of the
education. You don't have the right to disrupt the event. You don't have the right, yeah.
That's part of the education.
Got it.
Where it gets dicey, and I sometimes, you know, get a little bit more sympathetic with you for university administrators who find themselves in very dicey situations. You might remember a few years ago at Berkeley when a pretty far right-wing speaker came, and there was massive protests, mainly by outsiders, but it got violent. There was damage to the university. They were throwing rocks. They were storming. They were outnumbering the university police. And so the university shut that one down. And they were criticized for shutting it down. But you know, in that case, I have a little bit more sympathy because of its obligation to protect public safety, to protect the safety of the university community. But shy of that, I think that more speech on college campuses is helpful. It is useful. It is why the academy exists.
So even though more than 300 members of the House said that that phrase, from the river to the sea, is anti-Semitic when they weighed in, I mean, you're all saying that if someone wants to scream that on a college campus, as long as it is not disrupting someone's education, it's not in a class, it's not, you know, disrupting, it's not threatening the physical safety of Jewish students, that you're both okay with that. That is free speech.
Yeah, I mean, I think I could draw some things around that from you. If you are going to a Jewish student's dorm room and shouting it in their face in a way that would make a reasonable observer believe that it is meant as a threat to that student, and you do it every day, that's going to be a Title VI violation. That's going to sort of meet the severe and pervasive test, though I'm not sure it's going to matter too much what you're screaming at them probably in that case. But yes, if there is a speaker, a pro-Israel speaker inside a meeting room or a auditorium giving a speech, and you are outside on the sidewalk screaming from the river to the sea, this speaker should get the heck off our campus. Absolutely, that should be allowed. As long as the speaker is able to speak, as long as you're not harassing students going in to hear that speaker or, you know, assaulting anyone. And again, I'm sort of giving examples of recent stuff that's happened lately. You don't have a First Amendment right to protest in someone's home in their backyard just because they're a state official by virtue of working at a state university. And on the flip side, by the way, I don't think schools should be canceling pro-Palestinian speakers because of protests that might erupt from pro-Israeli groups. This is where, you know, Mo's point on the Berkeley campus, and I just disagree. The second you give in to a heckler's veto, you're going to get a lot more hecklers, because all you've said is that there need to be enough hecklers to shut down the event.
You know what? I want to pick up this. I want to pick up this USC example in a minute, but we got to take a really quick break, and we'll come back and pick up on this conversation. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. Okay, we are back with Left, Right, and Center. I'm here with Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy. And we were just getting into a pretty extraordinary story at USC when it comes to what we've been talking about. The valedictorian of this year's graduating class at USC, Asna Tabassum. She's a biomedical engineering major. She minors in resistance to genocide. She has been active on social media supporting Palestinian causes, something that she says she does not regret and will continue. There are some Jewish organizations on campus who say that they interpret some of her messaging as anti-Semitic. But the extraordinary move here, USC decided to cancel her speech, citing security concerns. That is why they said they canceled it. But she, you know, she's upset that she's not going to have the chance to speak. And I wonder, I mean, did USC do the right thing here if they did indeed think that her security was at risk?
No, I want to be very clear. They did the absolute wrong thing because, to the Berkeley point that Mo was making, all you've done is incentivize groups that don't like a speaker to now raise the bar. It's not just that they need to send in politely worded letters about how, like, well, actually the speech is offensive to me. They need to threaten violence and then you'll cancel the speaker. So what do you think you're going to get more of after that? It's a terrible example to set for all of these students. And it's why we have rules about heckler's veto. But to the hypocrisy point, I just would like to make sure that schools do this in an even-handed fashion. Everyone should be able to speak, even if their views are controversial. And it is up to the university to provide the security and safety needed against hecklers, whether they're violent or not, to ensure that speech, even if it's white supremacist, even if it's transphobic, even if it's anti-Semitic, even if it's anti-Gazan, whatever you want to think about it, the content of the speech shouldn't matter. It should be the robust place to debate ideas, interact with ideas, challenge ideas. And that's where the university has failed in a fundamental part of their mission.
Mo?
Yeah, look, I think there's a major difference between what happened at USC and what happened at Berkeley. And I don't agree with USC's decision here. What happened at Berkeley, you know, wasn't preemptive. What happened at Berkeley was they shut a speech down when a bunch of outsiders who actually had nothing to do with the university came and stormed the campus and started committing violent acts. And the university's public safety department, police department, was overwhelmed by the sheer number of these people. So they couldn't discipline students, and they just couldn't guarantee the safety of everybody there. That's not this case. That's not what happened at USC or what is happening at USC. I'm a little bit more sympathetic to what happened at Berkeley than I am with what's going on at USC. But to your earlier question, David, look, this is where it gets complex, right? If a university... You know, we have seen cases of swastikas being painted on walls at universities or flyers with swastikas being put up. If the university finds a student is the one who did that, they have the right to discipline that student. That is not protected speech at most universities. If a group of people are marching across campus and standing outside of a black student group meeting screaming the N-word, I think you would see some sort of intervention by the university, and I think that is appropriate. I do not think that is protected speech. Because it gets into this notion, which Sarah has brought up, of harassment, right? And that's part of, I think I had sort of the two criteria: public safety, protecting your safety, and protecting your education. I think protecting you from harassment is part of that. And so,
but
when
who
you
decides
see
that? Like, I wonder if a student, and this gets back to the sort of thing that we were struggling with at the beginning. If there is a Jewish student who feels that a certain phrase, such as "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," is harassment, does that make it harassment? Or we're back to schools having to struggle with a swastika on the side of a wall is harassment, and that kind of phrase is not. And maybe that's the case, but this is the struggle that, and I think it's why we see the president of Columbia sitting there having a hard time in front of lawmakers.
Yeah, it's actually just not that much of a struggle, I think. These campuses have scores of lawyers who will tell them all about the precedents on Title VI. They're just being inconsistent in applying it, and they're afraid of their own students. They aren't being consistent in applying Title VI or First Amendment principles, whether the school's public or not. Often they say they abide by First Amendment principles. They all have policies. They just don't want to enforce them all the time. They sort of have a Potter Stewart, was a Supreme Court justice who had a pornography case. And he said, look, I can't define obscenity. I know it when I see it. These schools have been trying to do free speech. I know it when I see it for 20 years. It has failed. And it's why you're seeing so many of these schools institute new free speech boards, et cetera. And like, oh, our students are going to actually attend civics classes and how to agree to disagree and civil discourse on pluralism, because they've realized that this has been such an abject failure. And it's why FIRE, which has, you know, graded these schools, et cetera, is getting so much traction, because they've pointed out something that's been a problem. Not just that the schools have bad policies. These are the same schools that had speech codes on campus, bias police, where you like get benefited from turning in other students, even anonymously, for something you heard them say that was offensive. All of those things have been routinely struck down by courts. And what FIRE is pointing out is, and you're not even applying your own policies across the board and consistently with these students.
And FIRE, you're referring to the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, which has been very involved in this conversation, right?
For 20 years. I mean, they've been the one bringing these lawsuits against the speech codes and the bias response teams and all of those things that have been basically meant to shut down things on campus to provide those quote unquote safe spaces, make sure no one feels harm. And that's why this current moment, I think, feels so hypocritical, because suddenly they're saying, well, yeah, but we can't do that when it comes to Jewish students because free speech. And you're like, well, but for 20 years, students were having to report to the dean's office if another student anonymously misheard them say something that could have been offensive to someone maybe down the road.
All right. I want to move on to one other story, which is very related. It's part of our 50 states series on the show. We're trying to focus on one story in each state ahead of the 2024 election to see what we can learn about our politics from the ground up. And I want to go to Oklahoma this week. So in 2023, Judd Blevins was elected a city commissioner in Enid, Oklahoma. Shortly before his election, residents in this city of 50,000 people learned that he possibly had ties to a white nationalist group, Identity Europa. There was then further reporting showing more ties between Blevins and the group, and a pair of friends found pictures of Blevins at the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally in 2017, where he was holding a tiki torch. And that photo became central in a movement in this deeply conservative community to recall Blevins from office. Blevins, as this recall vote was coming, told voters he does not consider himself a white nationalist or a white supremacist. He is a Marine War veteran. He said he was at that rally in Charlottesville to protest the removal of statues of American soldiers. But he has been removed from his job. Voters in Enid, Oklahoma, this month recalled him. And I want you both to weigh on in the story. I'll tell you what I take. We have been talking so much in the last months about just let voters vote, like in this climate. And it's like we can throw labels at people and we can go all over social media and say, you know, we are horrified that so-and-so has these beliefs. But like at the end of the day, it's like in this democracy, if voters are able to weigh in with their vote, it's meaningful, it's action, it does something. And Blevins is no longer serving in public office in Enid, Oklahoma. Anyway, where are you both on this?
I mean, I'm with you, right? Like in
it's
Oklahoma,
cool.
In Oklahoma, voters said it is not okay. It is not okay to be tied to a white supremacist group. It is not okay to march alongside people saying Jews shall not replace us, right? That is not okay. We have seen several instances over the years of people who abuse mechanisms that are in place to remove someone from office early, recalls over policy differences.
Right.
But this feels like the right use of that mechanism, and the voters stepped up and they made their voice heard, and good for them.
I was just going to emphasize what Mo said, right? Recalls, impeachments, kicking people off the ballot, 14th Amendment disqualification. All of these things are ways of signaling that you don't trust voters. And they're controversial. They cause disunion. They cause division. And look, nobody even cared about this. It was left to voters. Voters, I don't even think we should say they made a good decision or a bad decision. They got to make the decision.
Right.
And no matter how that decision turned out, we should have said, that's a good way to do this.
Like, I do hope that we get on to the show soon a larger conversation about, you know, rural rage in rural America and kind of how people in communities maybe like Enid, Oklahoma, are misunderstood from the outside. But I think there are a lot of people on the left who have perceptions of like more red rural America that are just not true. And I think that there are a lot of people who would assume that like, oh, you know, there are a lot of Trump voters out there who probably are totally fine with someone in office who has ties to a white supremacist group. There is something about this that I think opens the door to a conversation about a place like Enid, Oklahoma. And if you haven't been to a place like this, the perceptions that you have and that maybe you should learn about it before you jump to conclusions about, you know, a community that you're not familiar with. There's just something meaningful about that.
I think we could so stand to have that conversation both ways, because I think there are a lot of people in rural areas who think that everyone who lives in a city supports defund the police or, you know, any number is okay with the level of violence or what have you. And they are often surprised when you see urban voters go in a direction that is counter to the Fox News narrative of them. So I think both are conversations that, our polarized information ecosystem doesn't give a lot of space for, except for this show.
There you go. And with that note, we are going to move to our left, right, and center rants and raves. Sarah, you want to kick us off?
Yeah. I just want to give a rave to math. Math is cool, and I feel like when you're young and you're in school, you're like, how am I ever going to use this? But I'll tell you how, kids. I'm trying to put wallpaper in my bedroom, and you need a lot of math because the wallpaper comes in rolls that are a certain width and a certain length, and your room is its own sort of dimensions. There's windows, there's cutouts, there's a door frame, and you're trying to figure out how many rolls of wallpaper you need for a room. You're going to be using everything, geometry, algebra. I'm not saying that I've used differential calculus yet in this process, but I'll tell you, I'm not done yet. I haven't actually found the correct answer.
Mo?
This is why I can't endorse math. If things are so complicated that they require it, you've lost me. I got a rant. And it is related to the what we spent a lot of this show talking about. I'm all for the right to protest. However, friendly advice to all, shutting down traffic is the absolute worst way to win hearts and minds. If your goal is to bring more people into your cause, do not shut down lanes of traffic. Do not shut down a bridge. All you're going to do is piss people off and they become less likely to listen to you. But that is not my rant. My rant is the reaction to that. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, after seeing people shutting down traffic at a protest, tweeted, quote, "I encourage people who get stuck behind the pro-Hamas mobs blocking traffic, take matters into your own hands to get them out of the way. It's time to put an end to this nonsense." Number one, did exactly what we talked about earlier, conflating Hamas and people who are sympathetic to the Palestinian people for political advantage. And then number two, all but advocating for vigilantism and political violence to stop protesters. If that is not shutting down dissent, if that is not government advocating for shutting down defense, I don't know what is. We need to be turning temperatures down. That kind of rhetoric doesn't help.
All right. Well, I want to rave about a reporter in Indianapolis. So it's sort of a rant then a rave. Caitlin Clark, the women's basketball star, first pick in the WNBA draft by the Indiana Fever. She often gives her family a heart gesture after games. And so at her introductory press conference, a columnist from the Indy Star, Greg Doyle, made the gesture to her. Let's listen.
Hi, Caitlin. Greg Doyle, Indy Star. Real quick, let me do this.
You like that?
I like that you're here. I like that you're here.
I do that at my family after every game, so.
Okay, it's well, let's start doing it to me and we'll be get along just fine. So, question.
So, a lot of people found that awkward, really cringy, and just not appropriate. And, you know, Greg Doyle went and wrote about the moment and was really open about the process that he went through. He said that he was in denial, saying, I didn't do anything wrong. He had anger. A lot of people came out and said that it was really cringy and inappropriate. At the end of the day, he just wrote, I now realize what I said and how I said it was wrong, wrong, wrong. I mean, it was just wrong. Caitlin Clark, I am so sorry. And I love that he got there. I love that he opened up about that it was a sort of like a vulnerable, well-intentioned moment that just landed in the wrong way. And he made the right decision and said, hey, I did this and I'm sorry. And I wish more people would do that. And we'd have a lot more productive conversations about when people do things that they feel are well-intentioned and offend or hurt people. That's it for today. Sarah and Mo, thank you as always, and thank you to the team who put this show together every week. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark Hay Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded by Sue Margulies and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We're distributed by PRX. I'm David Green, and we'll have more Left, Right, and Center next week. Hope you join us.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.